Someday we're going to get to do these podcasts again the way we used to, all of us cozy in a studio, but I don't know when that time is going to come. Hi, it's John Williams, and this is another edition of The Mincing Rascals. I'm speaking to you from a studio microphone at WGN Radio. In a moment, you're about to hear the less-than-perfect quality, zoomed-in edition of The Mincing Rascals, and it's another pretty good one. The gang was intent on starting on the national scene, but Eric, as he often does, diverted us to someplace else, and in this case, it was the city of Chicago's flag, so stick around for that. Hey, do you have knee pain? If you do, go to the Joint Relief Institute, for crying out loud. They sponsor the Mincing Rascals podcast. We really appreciate it. They are still an essential business, and still taking care of knee pain is essential. Since we're probably all going to be locked down for another 20 or 30 years, I suggest you get this thing fixed right now. They'll use digital imaging to see where your tissue's deteriorated. They put a lubricant into that spot and it works. This week, unsolicited, somebody called in on our radio show. It was such a nice guy, and he said, I just came out of the Joint Relief Institute. I'm not sure if he was in the Orland Park or Oak Brook location, but he said, you're absolutely right, John. The people there are so friendly and nice. They were so good to me. And he said, I got back in my car and I did not have to hold on to my knee as I did it for the pain. And I was just so happy for him. I'll be happy for you, too. Now, the Joint Relief Institute website is jointreliefinstitute.com. First visit is free. They've got an insurance expert to make sure you get the maximum coverage, too. So call this number. Actually, go to this website, jointreliefinstitute.com, or call them at 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Today is Thursday. It's May 14th, 2020. It's 1:41 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. And once again, we are the Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast we record from the studios of WGN Radio, the offices of WGN Radio. Listen for me weekdays, by the way, from 9 to noon on WGN Radio.
And I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Daily Politics newsletter.
I'm Austin Berg with the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio Newsroom.
I'm Eric Zorn, the potential fifth star on the Chicago flag.
Oh, come on, Eric.
What?
I said we were going to talk about the national stuff first.
We'll can't help it. You cannot help it.
Really. Of all of the silly things, you know, Bertrand gets on my case when I don't stay on topic enough, but Lori Lightfoot says we have four stars on our flag. How about the fifth star be the resolve that the city is showing in fighting this virus?
I guess it's not something I'm thinking a lot about right now. I'm not trying to be a wiseacre here. I think it was sort of this in this context of sort of the things that we've survived and all of that. I believe it was Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa. He didn't understand why we would do something like this. Those stars kind of represent something that's Chicago specific, like surviving the fire.
Yeah. It's premature. I mean, it's aspirational. Maybe we will do a great job, but let's not celebrate too soon here.
The stars are for the establishment of Fort Dearborn, the Great Chicago Fire, the World Columbian Exposition of 1893, and the Century of Progress Exposition in 1933-34. Those are what the four are now.
It's a weird collection of things to put on us. I mean, the two things would be these big expos, right? One of them is Fort Dearborn, which had sort of a checkered history, and there was a massacre there that was maybe kind of unpleasant. And then the fire, which was awful. Maybe the fifth star should be the underground flood or something, if it's going to be something. But I would agree with the alderman that it should be something Chicago based, and this is just something we endured. But like, it could be the Great Depression for that matter, but it's not, because it's got to be unique to Chicago. So
snowpocalypse.
I don't totally agree with that. I think that even though others might be going through the experience too, it is something that Chicago is going through. And in the end, I mean, it is a monumental shared city experience. If commemorating that or cheerleading us through that with another star on the flag, I don't think it's necessarily such a bad idea.
I'm vehemently opposed on aesthetic reasons alone. You just keep it four. It's the best city flag by like a lot.
And then we're going to have to get a new flag, frankly.
Think of all the tattoos that will need to be adjusted.
Wasn't there a movement during the council wars for there to be a fifth star for a slave ship? I thought I remembered something to that, like that from the African-American alderman in the city council at the
time. Yeah, and I think there was Daly also had something. Richie Daly had some thing that he wanted to put as the fifth star. This is like a constant thing with mayors.
That and renaming Lakeshore Drive. Those are two sort of evergreen things that come up periodically in, you know, Chicago when we want
to. Eric, maybe if we do a fifth star on the Chicago flag, it could be to remember the flyover that the Blue Angels gave the city. And you put out a one-word tweet prior to that, which was UGG. Kristen McQuarrie sort of took you to task, I noticed, on at least Twitter this week about that. You want to change your feelings or position on that?
Didn't do anything for me. And I thought whatever they spent on it, they should have spent on ventilators and PPE or assistance to the poor or something like that. Flyovers don't do anything for me. It seems like an empty gesture.
Anyone who wants a test can get a test, Eric. My God, you're not listening.
Okay.
That was a very interesting thing that happened. So at one of the press conferences, the president was asked about that.
As far as Americans getting a test, they should all be able to get a test right now. They should be able to get a test. That's the problem with a question like that. We go through a whole announcement saying we're number one in the world by far, by a factor of two and even three and four, depending on where you're looking. And I get a question, when will everybody be able to get tested? If somebody wants to be tested right now, they'll be able to be tested.
And then they do what they always do. They change the answer to anyone who needs a test.
You've said twice here today that every American who wants a test can get a test.
Yes.
That's not the case.
Not everybody should get a test because they have to have certain things and they're going to know when they're not feeling right.
Suddenly they were speaking affirmatively about, you know, an answer to a question that wasn't asked. I don't even know that that question matters so much anymore. You know, we're doing the best we can. And
well, it matters if it's not true and if it's being used to build support and it's not a truthful statement. That's why it matters.
You're still hung up on that, aren't you, Steve? The truthiness of this administration?
From time to time, yeah, it comes up. I mean, we had Dr. Most on, right? And he said that they don't have they're not testing as many people or all the people they want to do it right here in DuPage County.
I thought it was very interesting today to see the picture of, is it Dr. Bright or Mr. Bright?
Dr. Bright.
His name placard as he's testifying before Congress is Dr. Bright.
A career public servant and a scientist who has spent 25 years of my career focused on addressing pandemic outbreaks.
He's the ousted director of the federal office in charge of developing countermeasures to infectious diseases. He testified before Congress today.
Our window of opportunity is closing. If we fail to improve our response now based on science, I fear the pandemic will get worse and be prolonged. There will be likely a resurgence of COVID-19 this fall. It'll be greatly compounded by the challenges of seasonal influenza. Without better planning, 2020 could be the darkest winter in modern history.
Anthony Fauci said this week,
the idea of having treatments available or a vaccine to facilitate the reentry of students into the fall term would be something that would be a bit of a bridge too far.
Poetic and very pessimistic and not on page with the president. So the president has been pushing back too on Dr. Fauci, saying,
look, he wants to play all sides of the equation. I think we're going to have a tremendous fourth quarter. I think we're going to have a transitional third quarter.
When you say Dr. Fauci is playing both sides, are you suggesting that the advice he's giving
you is different? Surprised by his answer, actually. To me, it's not an acceptable answer.
Well, gee, who are you going to trust? The experts in infectious diseases or Donald Trump? Who can say who's right about that? These guys, Fauci and Bright, they know what they're talking about. They speak from a lot more authority than the rest of us do. They see this as being a real dangerous threat to the future of the country and to the next year. I have to take them at their word that they're not just cowards and that they know more than the president does about this. I take what they say very seriously, and I'm pretty bummed about it, actually.
In the most apolitical way, I feel like nobody really knows still what we have in our laps.
Right.
And I'm not questioning, I'm not questioning Dr. Fauci or any of these experts because they understand the science of it. Everybody wants to put something on a calendar and say, we're going to be here at this date and there at that date, because that's how we are. And instead of just kind of going with it. And I know that that doesn't mean anything to people who have a business that's suffering or is closing amid all of this. I've said this to other people and they've said, well, then why are we doing this? And why? So we're falsely sort of charting this course. No, we know we have a virus. We know it's contagious, but I don't know, you know, what that's going to mean in August. And I'm not sure they 100% know.
I'm sure they don't. And that's in this, and I think they certainly admitted that. Fauci spoke of his own humility in the face of this challenge. We don't know. There's so much that we don't know about this. You're absolutely right, Lisa, which is why it's annoying to me when you have people making these sunny predictions. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe Dr. Bright's prediction is too gloomy. Maybe, you know, he doesn't know either. Maybe we'll all develop immunity. Maybe it'll all go away like Trump thinks, but probably not.
Well, I was going to say, Lisa, just to sort of echo what you're saying, I'm sick and tired of people telling me that the key is testing and contact tracing and no one telling me how that's going to happen. You know, we keep hearing people say that, okay, so how's that going to happen? Or what's the strategy? What's the plan? And it never gets to that second sentence.
Well, that's because that's where the politics come in. It's your, you know, everybody's pointing at each other. I'm on day 4 of trying to get the Pritzker administration to answer my question about whether they've gotten enough swabs from that White House, as they said they were going to do on Sunday. They said they were getting a shipment on Sunday. And I've also asked if they will reach their goal of 64,000 tests a day, which the Harvard study said is the ideal. 64,000 tests a day. I have not been able to get that question through to the governor's office.
Who are they testing exactly? Are people coming in who are completely asymptomatic who just want to test? Because these tests, they're not random, right? They're not like stopping people on the street like a pollster to take them.
No, but you could drive up and say, I think I've got, I have symptoms of this. I mean, there are drive up locations at some of the community hospitals and elsewhere.
You need to present symptoms. I mean,
No, not in every site now, John. I think they are taking it some sites, yeah.
If you just said, I want to get a test because some places it's not the case. Austin, you were going to say what?
The focus of the coverage of that testimony, I think, was on the doom and gloom because there wasn't a plan for a vaccine. And I mean, we don't have a vaccine for a lot of things, and we may not get a vaccine for this for a long time. So I think there was probably a misalignment of expectations of people about, you know, we're going to get a vaccine in the fall and this is going to be cleared up.
We still don't have a vaccine for AIDS.
Yeah.
We have treatment for it. That's very effective, but we don't have a vaccine for it. It's a viral infection.
And that's the medical. There was someone from Harvard talking about comparing this to the AIDS outbreak and how we should think about turning our attention to how to live best with a harm reduction principle, living with this virus as we do with AIDS going forward, because of the incredible toll it's going to take if we have this severe of lockdowns for much longer in a lot of states. That there's a cost to that too, and you need to take both of those into account.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't that what Pritzker was kind of getting at? That sort of we're going to be in this world until we get to a vaccine where we are going to have to learn to how to live with this, and that's an evolving thing.
That's what he's saying, but what people are experiencing on the ground is, I can't do anything. I can't open my business. This is not living with the virus. And one of the, and we've been talking a lot about approval data on the stay-at-home orders. And one thing I was always curious about is, well, what part, like just the idea that people should stay at home, is that what you're measuring favorability of? Because I think most people would, of course, say, yeah, like it's probably better than not if more people stay at home. And there was an interesting Ogden and Fry poll that got released yesterday that said 75% of Illinoisans favor opening small retailers immediately with the same guidelines as the large retailers. And that is not what the stay-at-home order is right now. Yeah. And there's a lot of those businesses that aren't going to even be open even as of June 1st.
But
that's a totally different discussion.
Yeah, awesome. I mean, I would count myself as one of those 75% who favor that, even though I'm pretty militant about control measures. But I don't see why you couldn't have a clothing store doing curbside pickup. I mean, these rules are not like, hey, the store's open, come on in and shop and fight for bargains with people at the clothing rack. This is a much more ordered, physically distanced kind of shopping that you can do. And it does seem to me like if you can prop up some businesses doing that, that seems reasonable to me. It's all about maintaining this distance, keeping the spread down, but at the same time having it be reasonable what people can do. Because I think there is a lot of internal pressure building up in society of people who are just very frustrated, very scared about the future if businesses can't open and if they can't make a living and they can't feed their families. And, I've said this every week for the last 3 or 4 weeks on this podcast. I understand very strongly how people are afraid now and what they're feeling and how frustrated they are. Having accommodations for those people is good. I think you could do that without opening up the tavern so everyone can run in and infect one another.
But it goes back to Lisa again that there's no plan, right? Because it sounds as if you're saying that the governor has shifted the goalpost. When these stay-at-home orders started, this was about bending the curve or managing hospital capacity, and with the idea that people, when we started to reopen, people were going to continue to get sick, but the rate of infection will have been leveled off to an extent to where the hospitals can handle it. Now I'm hearing you guys say things like, well, we're going to stay shut down until nobody's going to get sick again. And that's not reasonable. And that will collapse. That will absolutely collapse.
That is collapsing.
Yeah, I think the cracks are totally showing on that. And I do think it was a moving of the goalposts, even if it's only rhetorically, because that's how people consume what's going on. It's like through rhetoric. So it was flatten the curve and now it's find the cure. And that's two very, very, very different things.
Well, John, you probably talk to more ordinary people than the rest of us put together. What's your sense how in the past 2 months have the callers to your show, the people you're talking to, the WGN listeners, how are they changing in the way they're processing all this?
Steve, what do you think we're hearing on that?
People are still pretty supportive, but there are individuals who are very not supportive.
Well, there's more of those individuals. I mean, yeah, maybe 75% of the people... No, wait, 75% of the people you said favor some sort of limited opening. I think that number is getting bigger. People are getting antsy. They're getting angry, not getting their unemployment checks, some of them.
My daughter hasn't even gotten her stimulus check yet.
Yeah, I've been talking to tons of business owners, especially on the freelance and independent contractor side, that are still totally out of luck. You got to think of this order from May 21st to June 1st. Will have been, March 21st to June 1st, will have been, I think, 72 days or 71 days. Most small businesses have an average of like 25 days cash on hand. So you're talking about complete annihilation of a lot of these people if you go even to June 1st. Some of them haven't gotten benefits.
Yeah, but of course, even if you were to be able to open them up at full capacity, this is one of the problems that restaurants are facing. It's like, okay, let's say we open up restaurants at 25% capacity. Restaurants don't operate with a 75% profit margin. I mean, most of them are operating very close to the edge when they're at full capacity or they're able to seat everybody that comes in. So, and then you look at something like, did you see the picture that went viral this week of the United Airlines flight that was packed? Somebody sent a photo and it's like you see row after row of people shoulder to shoulder with their masks on. And you just look at that and think, would I want to be on that flight? And I think the combination of those realities is really going to continue to impact business no matter what the governor says.
It will continue to impact to some extent, but the lockdowns have a non-zero effect on the amount of business that they're able to do. I think we can't have a choice between open up, and it doesn't matter if we open up because some people aren't going to be comfortable anyways, and complete shutdown. So like Madison County, I think, is a great example. That county has elected Democratic state representatives for years. And they voted overwhelmingly at the county level to open up in defiance of the order.
Madison County, Illinois?
Yeah, which is in the Metro East region.
Madison, Wisconsin, I was going to bring them up. But we seem like we hit on this point every week. While we have faith in the doctors and scientists, I don't know that we need to cede the decision to them. Fauci can say that it's a bridge too far for the schools, or Dr. Bright can say that this is going to be our darkest winter if we're not conservative about our approach to this. Who said that they get to decide?
Well, it's like Fauci.
Politicians have.
But I think the politicians are the right ones to decide, aren't they? Right?
It's like if Fauci is a fireman and he shows up to a fire, he's not going to be satisfied until every ember is out. Well, you know, that's the fireman's role. The doctor's role is to make people as absolutely safe as possible. But that's not a realistic situation, right? I agree with you, John. So then the politicians have to come in and say, enough of the fire is out. then we are safe enough to move forward.
Okay, or do the fire analogy. So you say, hey, that fire is almost out. He says, no, I want to keep putting water on that fire. And you say, wait, there's another fire over here we need to address. It's the economic fire. It's people's lives and businesses there. And so if we just give all of the decision-making to the Dr. Fauci's of the world, wouldn't this be refreshing if Trump or Pritzker or somebody said, okay, we hear you. We're going to go ahead and let the businesses open it up. And some of you are going to die. And here's the projection of the models. And if that's what the people want, so be it.
Well, if I can continue this metaphor a little bit, if it's like
Fauci. Please improve upon it.
Well, Fauci showed up to this fire and there's still some embers going. Everyone says, go away, Fauci, fireman Fauci, you put it out. And he says, and what he's saying right now, he's saying, look, if I walk away from here and I just let these embers go, a breeze is going to kick up and it's going to light the house next door on fire and the house after that on fire.
Maybe.
You have to be careful.
But in the meantime, you're guaranteed that the other half of the town is going to burn down, Eric, because that's the economic side.
And I think you see like the evidence of the fires or evidence of absence in Georgia, Colorado, and Florida, all three of which are doing way, way, way better than Illinois, all three of which opened up far earlier. And our Democrats and Republicans, Polis is no right winger.
It's going to come to a point where we have to say, what the hell's going on in Illinois? I mean, you know, the New York numbers are dropping. It's Cook County now is going to have as many cases as Queens County in New York. I mean, it seems like on the scale of it, Illinois has not had the success that other states have been having. Am I wrong about that?
And I don't think you are wrong about it right now. I mean, we ran a column in Monday's paper by Dennis Byrne. He was basically doing an end zone dance about how he's now moved to Florida, a former Sun-Times columnist and Tribune columnist. He was talking about how great Florida is doing, how they know how to open up. Illinois doesn't know how to open up. Suck on it, Illinois. And I think it's too early for us to conclude that they've done it the right way in Florida and in Georgia and these places that have opened up early, you know, and I really hope that they did do it the right way. I hope that it shows up that they're right and that they relax and we can relax in the same way and we can get things going again. But I think it's too early to say that, right?
But Governor Pritzker said weeks ago, we are bending the curve. We've begun to bend the curve.
There is a deceleration of virus transmission. We are, in fact, bending the curve.
And I haven't heard any good news since then. I mean, there's one day of 42 deaths, but, you know, and I'm honestly not up to speed on hospitalizations, where we are in that. And that's probably the best metric, but I just don't feel like we're still losing ground.
Lisa, what have you thought of in terms of you were talking about, there's not been any answers on getting the testing up. One thing where I've seen kind of a real reticence to take responsibility and to have clear goals is in the nursing homes in Illinois.
Well, yeah, that's about almost half of long-term care facilities, but they are known as nursing homes. Deaths there represent about half of the deaths statewide. And there seems to be sort of we're doing the best we can. We're going to step up inspections, surprise inspections and the like. I don't know how to solve that problem. They don't know how to solve that problem. I think we're going to have to start thinking about long-term care, nursing homes, and how they're set up. On the one hand, it feels like it's too late. On the other hand, I don't know how you control that. The money's not there to increase staffing. So you have one person going from one room to the next room to the next room. And the spread is inevitable. There's a concern about sort of going to a hospital, another congregate setting, and then spreading that there.
Has anyone seen a breakdown as to the ages of the people who have died? I noticed that when we run our obituaries in the Tribune, a lot of them are in their 80s and 90s. And then when every day they run a list of people who die and say like, you know, Cook County, one woman in her 30s, one man in his 40s, and like six people in their 60s. And I mean, it's the numbers are really seem very dramatically skewed toward a very older population.
Dr. Azike said, I think earlier this week, that 90% of the fatalities in Illinois are either elderly or with a pre-existing comorbidity situation.
Right. So comorbidities, I think, at least for Cook County, last I saw, it's over 90% of the cases of the deaths had comorbidities. Right. And then the age data that Eric mentioned is very striking. It's less than 5% of the deaths are under age 50. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean
50 is very young to me.
Though. Yeah, how about 57? Yeah.
Well, so under 60, yeah. under the age of 60, you also see less than 5% total if you add that. So, and that's not to say, like, who cares about people over age 60, but it does require a different approach. And the reason I asked about the nursing homes is, like, if half of the cases are related to those, that seems to have demanded a much stricter, swifter response than still talking about this in week 8 of how we're going to do more testing or quarantine in nursing homes. Because I think you're right, Lisa, it probably is too late.
Actually, my mother-in-law is in a long-term facility in Lake County, and for weeks now she's been confined to her, you know, two-room sort of, it's really less than an apartment, but she cannot get out. They just started last week where if it's above 55, they will wheel the residents out to a courtyard so that a family member can sit 10 feet from them. But otherwise it's been locked down. But they had one case a few weeks ago. They've got two more now, and they've got workers who they say they know the workers are bringing it in. And they said in a conference call that they can't get the test they need to test and find out to keep everyone isolated. But even as of it was earlier last week or late this week, that they still weren't getting that they weren't comfortable with the testing they were doing.
We should have learned a little bit. Yes, nobody knew how to handle this, perhaps, but at least we should have been looking at Seattle and seeing what was unfolding there.
And Italy. Yeah, we totally Italy, had the data.
Correct.
Well, is the part of the conversation, do people die with COVID-19 or of COVID-19? If you're 88 years old and you also had a pre-existing pneumonia or heart condition or diabetes, then is that the same as it striking a healthy 33-year-old? I mean, well, do we put a tally mark?
You know, I don't think you mean to be doing it, but in a way you're making Donald Trump's case. He says the numbers are inflated because someone will die of a heart attack and they'll call it coronavirus.
Well, I'm trying to figure that out. I mean, once Camp says they're fewer, obviously it's the administration and their allies, and others are saying we maybe are underreporting it. I don't know. And I don't know that it is, in fact, I'm not sure what the purpose of the scorekeeping is anyway. They're dead. But is it the same thing?
No, I do think it's interesting. And when I used to cover the police beat, we would look at the medical examiner sheets and you would see sort of primary cause of death is this. And a contributing factor, is sort of like underlying heart condition. So you'd see maybe a gunshot victim, but they didn't survive, you know, because of some kind of, I'm just throwing that out, some underlying.
Or you'd cause. See it, Lisa, you'd see it in exposure deaths, people who died on the street.
Sure, sure.
And then, but it was also alcohol poisoning.
But not just that. If you look at them, it was any number of things. But yeah, that does stand out. But any number of those cases, or if you see somebody who had been ill for a long time conversely, somebody who had gotten hurt, who was really, really badly wounded in a shooting, and then years later, they contract pneumonia. Still a homicide case, but the pneumonia was the thing that took over, one causing the other, almost.
Aren't they looking at number of deaths? I mean, because with a huge population, you have a certain number of deaths every day. And what we've seen is a dramatic increase or noticeable increase in those numbers of deaths every day. This is, if you remember, this is how they figured out how many people died in the heat wave of, was it 95?
Yes.
They realized all of a sudden, like, yeah, there are a lot of people who, and a lot of them were elderly too. But that's how they kind of measure this. They go like, well, this is many more deaths than we would expect. And that's why New York, and I think Dr. Fauci was also saying that they feel like the deaths are undercounted. So
that we're looking for is excess deaths some comparable period. But the uncomfortable reality is hospital administrators are in a very, very difficult spot. Because they're having to lay off a ton of staff, which is counterintuitive to us because all we talk about is how much the healthcare system is strained, but they're actually having to lay off all these people because they can't do, you know, elective surgeries. Yeah. So they're in the uncomfortable position of, do you put someone on a ventilator for 5 minutes, even though they don't need it, and get the $35,000 or whatever you get for reimbursement for that? Or do you say if somebody has COVID symptoms, of which there are very many, do you put that down as a cause of death or not? And that's a very difficult moral question for those people.
It seems to me too that it's just one of those questions where we're getting off track. I mean, the fact is that there are way too many people dying of this, and whether it's inflated by 10,000 or deflated by 10,000,
yeah.
I don't know how much it really changes the story that we're telling or talking about.
And, you know, Eric was saying earlier, well, we just, there's so much we don't know about it. I think that's what's a little frightening to you. We had Eric Romage on, that guy from UMass Dartmouth, who is the epidemiologist that collated a lot of the data out there. His piece about that kind of blew up in the last week, where he just said, here's some case studies at a restaurant, at a concert, at a church, at a sporting event. And they sort of did the contact tracing, and you could see who was sitting at what table, who got it from whom, when. We asked him if more people are getting it from touch or more people are getting it from the air, right? Because we're so hung up on wiping everything down. Oh, I got to get wipes, 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 wipes. But these super spreading incidents seem to be predicated on people breathing the same air rather than touching surfaces. And his answer was discouraging. He said, we don't know. We do not know how people are getting this disease.
There was a story maybe 2 months ago now about a choir that had gotten together. And they
tell that story. Go ahead, Eric.
They'd been really careful about staying physically distant from each other and practicing their singing, and then a whole bunch of them got sick.
They were at this church. They were aware, and they didn't do the normal hugging and kissing, and they really put in what, you know, the best practices we knew at that time in place to really lower their risk. But what wasn't known at the time was how much singing and yelling, for that matter, can actually put virus into the air. And, it was just a terrible outcome that, of this choir of 60 people, 45 of them became ill from a single choir session.
And there was just a paper that I read earlier this week about the fact that singing is uniquely bad for people who want to avoid contagion, because you're singing, you're projecting these droplets through the air, and everyone's projecting their droplets and breathing in. So it would seem to me that the evidence is at least suggestive of there being this kind of air transfer.
But he also said you could accumulate the germ or the virus through the day. So like, say you need to get to 2,000 particles, I could pick up 1,000 from talking to John, and then 500 from talking to Austin, and then 500 from touching a banister, until I get to the magic number.
This is why, through
a period of a day or so.
That if you get a handful, you might not get it, but if you get enough, you might. And that's why I was talking to somebody face-to-face the other day who I speak, I might have been here at work, and I thought, wow, we shouldn't be doing that. We should be talking at 45-degree angles from each other. Literally, it's another like measure of behavioral change. BuzzFeed had a piece this week. It was 10 pictures of restaurants around the country, or images of how restaurants around the world are managing, the next chapter of their lives. And they showed at a four top, you will sit catty corner to each other, diagonally rather than right across from each other. They showed plastic, clear sort of cases around tables so that you'll all sit there, but you'll be in your little clear cocoon. They had all of these ways that restaurants will reopen, and none of them looked any fun.
That doesn't sound fun at all.
I do not want to go to these places,
Oh, man.
Well, that is one of the things somebody raised earlier here, this whole idea of opening at 30% capacity, or do we just sort of throw open the doors and let people, kind of live their lives? But I wonder if there's something in between here, because I am not inclined to really want to go right now. We're trying to sort of make sure we hit all of our places and take things to go. We would continue on our course here of hitting up our favorite local places, but taking it out.
Well, then what do you guys think about what happened in Wisconsin today? And maybe not tomorrow. Some of the cities are cracking down, but the Supreme Court up there said that the governor's reach was too extreme and that they can open up for business. I mean, bars were open elbow to elbow in Wisconsin today, the 14th of May.
You have to decide what your goal is, I think. And I think the original goal of flattening the curve and not overwhelming the healthcare system is probably the most balanced goal that we can have. Should we be packing bars with people? No. But I think there needs to be some personal responsibility and responsibility on part of the business owners there. And there may be some legal liability for some of those businesses, where you can strike sort of a balanced approach. I think before the show we were mentioning Appleton. I'm thinking of this, like, the most divey, dingy Christmas bar in Appleton, Wisconsin right now, and how I would hate to be there. It's just dark and there's no windows, but there's tons of Christmas lights. Yeah, we're going to have to see. And as Eric said before, we're going to know pretty quickly whether what effect that had. It's too early to tell.
You mean, like, literally from this event, well, in 14 days, we have a spike in little towns in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. What's the hospitalization? What are the hospitalizations and deaths going to look like in Wisconsin after that happens? I'm not sure.
And again, you hope that it's zero, right? You hope it's like, well, hey, you know, they all got together in a bar and it was fine. And that will augur for more things like that going forward. It seems there's a difference to me, a really big difference between, like, being allowed to play golf in a foursome and being allowed to jam yourselves into a tavern. And that's where I feel like our elected leaders need to really calibrate their restrictions and figure out what's dangerous. And if it does turn out that proximity is important, that if you sit at a table with someone, that's a bad way of exchanging viral droplets. But if you're just passing somebody on the sidewalk, I think Los Angeles just yesterday, sometime this week, issued an edict that everybody, when they're outdoors, has to wear a mask. Now, I'm into masks. I wear them when I go shopping, but when I'm walking to the store, I don't have a mask on. I mean, at some point, it's ludicrous.
Where do you wear it? Where do you have your mask when you're walking to the store?
Oh, I put it on when I get 20 feet from the door.
Do you put it when you walk near people?
If I were going to be passing right by somebody on the sidewalk, I shop really early in the morning, so I usually don't run into anybody. But yeah, I mean, I see people driving their cars with masks on. Yeah. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, at some point, people don't understand what's going on here, and I think people will see that and they think we've all lost our minds, and that doesn't breed respect for sensible restrictions that people have. So then you have people going, well, we've all lost our minds. Let's go to the tavern and jam in there because this is all a big hoax.
We live near a couple of bus lines. We live near the train. I walk to the store too, but I definitely have it around my neck and pop it up. There's just no way. There's just so much foot traffic.
Well, what did you make of, here's a sentence that jumped out at me this week. The head of the Illinois Restaurant Association said that the governor is holding businesses hostage. And I hated the sound of that. I think that's an unfortunate metaphor, Austin.
Imagine if you're him. So I was talking with Justin Kaufman on his Saturday show about this and with some restaurant owners. And Sam Toya, the head of the Illinois Restaurant Association, restaurants employ 500,000 people. And the fact that they were not consulted whatsoever on the plan is insane. Every other state I've looked at has some public or behind the scenes involvement with groups like that. And the fact that they were not consulted at all in Illinois is just bonkers to me.
You mentioned that last week in this podcast, and I don't think we gave that enough attention because I either didn't know that or didn't pay enough attention to that. That's really heavy-handed. That sounds really myopic. Why didn't the governor ask the restaurant association what's a reasonable plan?
I think he's flying by the seat of his pants, and they're trying to base their decisions based on polling. And that plan, I think, as I said last week, seemed more geared toward people who wanted a plan that they could point to versus actually giving certainty or a scorecard to anybody. And I still believe that to be true. This was the problem. Just as Eric was saying, like, you need to have respectable laws in order to have respect for the law. The fact that he's keeping to issue these 30-day emergency orders, arguing in court that that's legit, you can't do that forever. His argument in court is that you could theoretically do that forever, which you shouldn't be arguing as an executive. I think he's had some of the strictest restrictions combined with some of the least transparent processes, which is a really bad mix.
Well, I said this last week, and I agree. I think that you can't keep calling 30-day emergency sessions. You have to bring the legislature in. They're coming in. The emergency declarations are for emergencies, and they're for emergencies that you can't have the leisure time of calling all the legislators in and hearing a bill and all this stuff like that. You have to, you know, sometimes you have to act and you can't wait around. I get that. Everybody gets that. But after 30 days, you should be able to, under the circumstances, bring the legislature in. And remember, we have co-equal branches of government. It's time to do that. I was talking to Sam Toya myself this week for my column for tomorrow, and it has to do with the new law, you know, or the new rules in Chicago, where they're going to compel Grubhub and DoorDash and Uber Eats and those places to reveal on their receipts how much commission and fees and all that other stuff that go into the purchase price. And I think it's a good idea to have, you know, third-party fees revealed. And you should probably always call your restaurant ahead of time and see if they can handle it without going through Grubhub.
Yeah, good idea, though, Eric. So what a sure, it's a good idea. Should the city force that? When that came up, we had the head of consumer affairs for the city on about that, and she was pitching why they were doing it, how good it would be for everybody.
This way, the customer has a fully informed receipt, which is actually, you know, any smart consumer should want that.
I got to say, the pushback was pretty swift on our text line. People just going, wait, this is a private business transaction. If they want to bury the cost, or if they've got a business model that works for them, that's their business. The city, even if their intentions are good, really has no business mandating that they operate their business in a certain way.
It is in a free enterprise system. Restaurants always have had a choice whether to use a thing like Grubhub, right? They could always say, you know, if you don't like their fees, don't use them. Use another right. service or don't do that. And I think that rationale worked fine when Grubhub orders were just a sort of a small part of a lot of restaurants' businesses, that they didn't make as much money on a Grubhub order. It didn't really matter. Now that they're really strapped and they're losing, you know, 30% commissions in some cases to these things, they want to inspire customers not to go through Grubhub if they can, and or to put some pressure on Grubhub to lower those commissions and fees.
Right, but the city then steps in as the referee on that.
But you have laws about requiring third party disclosures on things like tickets that you buy. When you're buying a house, there's all those things that have to be disclosed to you about who's charging you what and so on. I don't have a real problem with it so much, but I think we need to realize, and this is one thing that Toya said that really stuck with me, is that restaurants are really the soul of our neighborhoods and our communities. And I never really thought of it that way, but I think in some ways it's very true that you think about your community, your area, it is in a lot of ways defined by the restaurants. And we wanted them there before this all happened, and we want them there after this is all over. And so ways that we can support them are really important. And one way you can support the restaurant is just to call it first before you go to Grubhub or Uber Eats. Call the restaurant or go to their website and say, you know, hey, should I pick up? Can you deliver? How can we best work together to support right. you?
The president and vice president both have staff members working close to them who have come down with COVID-19. I did see a long lens on the vice president wearing a face mask as he's now did a short tour of some sort of, he wasn't even socially distanced, but at least he had a face mask on. President still has not been photographed with a face mask on, and as far as we can tell, isn't social distancing or protecting himself or people around him much.
A little bit of me wishes that they were self-isolating.
Pritzker, someone close and high up in Pritzker staff yeah. also tested positive, so yeah. he's been self-isolating. Yeah, I do wish that they would wear masks in cases where they're warranted. If Mike Pence is out walking on the street with Secret Service, I don't know if it warrants a mask, but...
But Austin, the vice president's explanation has been he gets tested every day and he always tests negative. That doesn't mean that he can't get it and give it. He could be in that latency period where you've just picked up the virus and you don't have the disease yet, but you could yet spread it, I've been told, or at least there's the possibility. I mean, it's just so stupid on so many levels for those two people to not walk the walk. You always see them without a mask, near people.
Here's something that ought to inspire them. If both Trump and Pence are incapacitated by coronavirus, Nancy Pelosi becomes president.
Yeah.
that ought to put the masks on them right away. I mean, I think the president should wear a mask in public as a symbolic gesture, nothing else, just to show people, like, look, it's not a bad thing to wear a mask. I'm wearing a mask. When you're in these kind of situations, you should also wear a mask. I think that's modeling by example and it's something he should be doing.
Right. I think I've seen some commentary too that sort of, or is that to send a message about where they stand? I don't know. I don't know the answer.
I'm sorry, Lisa, what does that mean?
That not wearing the masks, does that telegraph to the public their view of how scared people should be? Sort of the least you have to do, right? I mean, put on the mask, just do it.
When you go to the grocery stores now, Every single person is wearing a mask. I was at Home Depot. Mm. They're counting the people that come in and out. You could have 50 people there. Everybody has a mask on. And it's amazing to me how quickly we've all adapted to it. I think the president has been going through the same sort of thing we all did at first, a little vanity or a little discomfort with it. And now you just go, oh, what the hell? Put the thing on. This is what it looks like. And this is the way I have to live right now. I wonder if the reverse of this is the case, Eric, that Obamagate is them trying to distract us from it. The same way a mask might focus our attention on the problem is, I'm not sure what Obamagate is, by the way. And I don't think I have to know what it is, whatever that is.
It's the worst.
Read the newspaper.
It's the worst crime in the history of the U.S. presidency.
What crime exactly are you accusing President Obama of committing, and do you believe the Justice Department should prosecute him?
Obamagate. It's been going on for a long time. It's been going on from before I even got elected. And it's a disgrace that it happened. And if you look at what's gone on, and if you look at now all of this information that's being released, and from what I understand, that's only the beginning. Some terrible things happened, and it should never be allowed to happen in our country again. And you'll be seeing what's going on over the coming weeks. But I wish you'd write honestly about it. But unfortunately, you choose not to do so. Yeah, John, please.
Crime. What is the crime exactly that you're accusing him of?
You know what the crime is. The crime is very obvious to everybody. All you have to do is read the newspapers, except yours.
Yeah, I literally thought at that time, he knows it's a thing, but he doesn't know what that thing is yet either. So he just knew to push that button, but he didn't even know what it did yet.
And there, I mean, in the following days, you saw kind of through traditional channels and kind of right-leaning media that stuff, new information come out. So like on the unmasking of Flynn, and then Biden was forced to answer for that. He tried to call a shot in a very over-the-top way, and then was backed up by kind of just these minor talking points about who knew what when, but it could grow into something bigger. It was the New York Post, front page of the New York Post.
But how seriously should we pay attention to this Flynn stuff?
Too early to tell. I think the fact that Biden was aware of sort of what turned out to be kind of an investigation into political rivals is going to matter to some people who already like Trump already. I don't think it will matter to independents whether they're choosing between Trump or Biden, really.
No, I think it's one of those inside Washington stories that is not going to get a lot of purchase outside of the far extremes in the cable news environment. I mean, all these other stories are, you know, sort of interesting. And, you know, I did a column this week about the new head of the Fraternal Order Police. It was the first column I've written in just ages that didn't somehow revolve around the coronavirus.
An important thing to note about that, I think, was so they if you haven't read Eric's column, they elected a super pro-Trump head of the FOP, and which the FOP is kind of, that's how they lean. I think it should be give pause to people who keep saying that we need an elected police accountability board, because cops vote and people like that can run for it. So I've been talking about this for a while, but we need an LA style police accountability board that's appointed. And I think if you, the current, proposal going through city council right now would have it be an elected accountability board, and you would get people like that on the board, guaranteed.
I'm a big believer in democracy. I agree with you on this, Austin. I'm also not very gung-ho about an elected school board. For sort of similar reasons, I think you throw electoral politics into these sort of regulatory bodies, you can end up with all kinds of people with all kinds of agendas, spending all kinds of money to in the campaigns. I have to say I'm averse to that sort of stuff. So, and it's not just this guy's pro-Trump, by the way. He's got a really long and checkered disciplinary history. Things like he was. Right. Off duty because of a back injury, and they caught him working security at a restaurant, all that stuff is online, and it's pretty troubling. They elected someone who is, well, let's just say he's not one of Chicago's finest.
Yeah, much more troubling than his political affiliation. I agree.
Yeah.
One last thing, guys. Last week I asked you if you had any optimistic predictions. Heather Sharon said she thinks that the schools will open in the fall. I visited with the president of Bradley University today, and they are announcing that they're going to have contact with the students on campus in the fall. That's their plan. He said 60% of the universities and colleges in the country are planning on contact learning in September, maybe August. Huh?
What do you mean by contact learning? You mean pretty much business as usual?
Yes, with modifications. But yeah, they will stay in the dorms. They'll eat in the cafeteria. They'll be in the halls.
The dorms, I the analogy to the cruise ships and dorms seems very apt to me. I don't know if I can see that being.
Well, you got to think who lives in dorms and who goes on cruises. One is a lot more vulnerable than another one.
That's true.
That's true. What was the number? 5% of the people under 50 are the ones with the disease.
California State University system has announced they're not going to be opening in the
fall. Right. Yeah, that's why it popped on my radar, Eric. So there's the yin and yang of this thing.
I think, as Lisa was saying earlier, we just don't know what course this is going to take. We'll know a lot more probably, you know, in early July. We'll have a really good sense as to what the fall is going to shape up like. I'm optimistic about the fact that competitive golf is coming back to TV.
And NASCAR.
And NASCAR, I don't care much about, but that. And I think it looks to me like baseball might be coming back.
Well, that's where I was going to go with this. I talked to Jason Benetti today, you know, the White Sox play-by-play guy. I said, I'm moving my July 15th start date. It's now July 14th. His is July 4th, you know, for obvious reasons. MLB is hoping to be at Wrigley Field and on the South Side, middle of July.
You called that. You said July 15th.
Isn't that weird, though, because that would be an 82-game season or 81-game season. Isn't it amazing that we can be excited about that, and it's still a couple months off?
Given the age profile of people who suffer from this, if you make sure that the people who are around in your team, obviously on your team, but sort of around your team, the coaches and trainers, if you make sure that they're not in vulnerable populations or with pre-existing conditions that make them vulnerable, that you could get through an 81-game season with – I mean, some people are going to get sick, right? I mean, it's just going to happen inevitably, but without this rampaging through the league. I'm wondering as a spectator what that's going to be like to watch games in empty stadiums. Even though I watch almost all my baseball, almost all my sports on TV, there is a sense that you get when you watch of just the excitement of the crowd and the event. And to watch it it's kind of like watching a spring training game, you know, where there's about 100 people in the stands. It's kind of just doesn't feel the same. And I'm wondering.
Or the first four innings of Cubs games in the summer.
Or any White Sox game.
Shut up, Eric. You know, this is the thing. This is where radio, if they were transparent about it, they could say, we're going to put ambient crowd noise in the background. Now the Sox game would even sound louder. And we're going to, when the guy hits the ball, we're going to amp the volume up. We're going to live produce it to give you a better product. Nobody's there.
Back to the days of Ronald Reagan at the Iowa radio station, right? You're going, here's a base hit.
I like the idea of like goofy sound effects too. If like someone makes an error. That'd be good.
I think it could work. I wonder, there was the issue that Pritzker kind of stepped in it the other day by talking about the greedy baseball players, and he got slapped down pretty good for that. But I wonder how some of these teams are going to do, because a lot of their revenue, I don't know what percentage, but certainly a significant percentage of their revenue comes from paid attendance. And so they're not going to have any of that. And yet they're still going to have to operate their stadiums and so on. So the question is, okay, so the players want to be paid the same per game as they would have been paid. So they're going to have you basically get half pay, but the team owners are not going to get anywhere near half the revenue that they would normally.
The owners say they're going to lose 40% because they can't open the gates. So between ticket sales, in stadium advertising, revenue from the beer concessions, that's 40% more. So you got to ask the players to take 40% of 50%. They've got to, And that's where a couple of the players, unfortunately, have said, I'm only making $15 million, and I'm not going to put my health at risk for 40% of the 50%. It's just not worth it. What a stupid thing to say, right?
Well, but the public seemed to be on the players' side, right? It makes sense to me that, you know, I say, okay, you know, everyone, we're all in this together, and the owners need to be reasonable about sharing the revenue. But the players would rather say, hey, we want our money first. But I mean, the consequences of that could be that you would have franchises that just fail, that can't make it.
Pritzker apologized, which I thought was odd. Like, I think this is his only apology of the last 2 months.
What did he say, Austin?
He said, you know, I'm sorry about, I don't have the quote in front of me, but he apologized for his remarks saying that the players need to take a pay cut. And it was really funny that he was forced to apologize that and for that versus any action that's been taken and disagreed with by other people.
Eric is backdrop. We usually do some post Eric's backdrop on his Zoom chat here. What are we looking at there, Eric?
Well, this is guaranteed rate field during a poorly attended game. give you a feel for how it's going to be this summer.
Austin has got nothing but a blank white wall behind him. I believe you described that as a French prison. Is that right?
Yeah. I try to let my hair do the talking.
And your hair is a mess.
You guys got to get some home clippers. That's what my son and I have been using, home clippers. Look how short and neat my hair is.
Your hair does look good. I'm wearing my bad hair like a badge now. I don't want to get it cut until we come out. I'm not going to get it cut until Bertha, my person, gets to cut it.
So it's like a playoff beard.
I noticed none of you guys are sporting pandemic beards.
No.
I've seen that a lot. Actually, people were just letting their facial hair grow.
All right, boys, good to hear you. Lisa had to check out. She had some real work to do, as did Steve Bertrand. We'll do this again next week. Thanks, fellas.
Bye.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.